Conference's Committee's inquiry into the prevention, investigation and prosecution of industrial deaths in Australia, and I welcome everyone here today. This is a public hearing and a Hansard transcript of the proceedings is being made. The hearing is also being broadcast via the Australian Parliament House website. Before the committee starts taking evidence, I remind all witnesses that in giving evidence to the committee, they are protected by parliamentary privilege. It is unlawful for anyone to threaten or disadvantage a witness on account of evidence given to a committee, and such action may be treated by the Senate as a contempt. It is also a contempt to give false or misleading evidence to a committee. The committee generally prefers evidence to be given in public, but under the Senate's resolutions, witnesses have the right to request to be heard in private session. If a witness objects to answering a question, the witness should state the ground upon which the objection is taken, and the committee will determine whether it will insist on an answer, having regard to the ground on which it is claimed. If the committee determines to insist on an answer, a witness may request that the answer be given in camera, and such a request may, of course, be given at any other time. I'd also ask witnesses to remain behind for a few minutes at the conclusion of their evidence in case the Secretariat needs to clarify any terms or references. I remind people in the hearing to ensure that their mobile phones are either switched to silent or switched off. And I now welcome to the table Michael and Lee Garrels. I understand that information on parliamentary privilege and the protection of witnesses and evidence has been provided to you. So for the Hansard record, would you please state your full names and the capacity in which you appear before the committee today?
Michael Garrels is my name. I'm Jason Garrels' father, who's deceased.
My name is Alethea. I'm known as Lee. My last name is Garrels. I'm the mother of Jason Garrels and also a member of the Interim Consultative Committee for Affected Families, Illness and Serious Injury.
Well, we received your submission, so thank you very much for that. We'll just have, you know, we won't make this too formal, so we'll just invite you to make some opening remarks to the committee, and then the senators will ask you some questions, and we'll really just try and do that in a conversational manner. So if you think and I'll give you an opportunity at the end too, if you think there's something that we haven't covered that you think's important that we know before you finish, I'll give you an opportunity to make some final remarks as well. So I'll open it up to you now for some opening remarks.
On February 27th, 2012, our son Jason, who was 20 years old, was killed in Claremont, Queensland, on a construction site. The state of that site, no one should have been working. It was that bad that the four-wheel drive ambulance couldn't get to him. It was too wet. They couldn't get their life-saving equipment to him because it was too wet. Just those factors alone, any chance of them resuscitating Jason was lost in that critical time. They had to push the ambulance off the site. All the local fire brigade was there. They pushed it off the site. That's a four-wheel drive ambulance. So I'm assuming you've read my submission, so I won't go right through it. But that alone, because I often hear people saying, oh, well, geez, you can work. Well, that proves you can't. If you can't get someone there to help someone, then you should not be working. That's just a lay down was there. The things I would like to raise is a culture that's across the country, I feel, even though, you know, some of this is Queensland-based, at the time of Jason's death. An inspector had been on the site, as I've put in my submission, and given a work improvement notice and what's called an ESPN, which is critical. Now, on those, I've got them here, so I'll hand them over, but on these notices, on the improvements notice, there's a little thing, I reasonably believe that you, and they tick the different boxes, have contravened a provision in circumstance that make it likely that the contravention will continue or be repeated. So he's saying, I think you're going to keep doing what you're doing. On the ESPN, which is the really bad one, he's ticked the box on this. The inspector reasonably believes circumstances causing an immediate risk to persons or property have arisen. He didn't turn the power off. That's all he had to do, was turn the power off. Instead, he gave that work improvement notice. Well, he didn't give it as such because he forgot his book. He travelled over 300 kilometres, an inspector, without his book. And I think I've said in my submission, that's a bit like a traffic cop going out without his book. Now, when we became aware of this, we raised it with the WorkSafe Queensland. We were told that he didn't have the right to do it under legislation. Now, I'm sorry, but if you have workplace health and safety on your shirt, you have the right to save people's lives if you think they're at risk, and he has stated he thinks people are at risk. So, for, I think, 2 years in the lead-up to the inquest that we're aware of this, we had this debate with WorkSafe Queensland, and I put to them, well, there's practical... I'm a linesman by trade many years ago, and I said, there's practical ways he could have done this. All he had to do was ring the local Ergon depot, get a linesman down, show him exactly what he could see, and believe me, it was a bastard of a sight, and say, well, look at that. They would have hopped up the pole, pulled the fuse. That would have caused an investigation. Now, further to that, he notified the Electrical Safety Office of Queensland. Under the Act, it says when one of these ESPN notices is issued that they have 3 days in which to act. The director that received that did nothing, not a thing.
This is the company director?
This is the Electrical Safety Office.
Right, OK.
Government regulator. They did nothing. Not a thing. So when we went to inquest, we pulled out the Act, much to WorkSafe's surprise. Now, at that particular time, in the lead-up to the inquest, because, of course, we're in conflict with the department, I got a letter from the Deputy Director that states that we have a conflict of interest, and that our ILSO, which is unique to Queensland and a good initiative, could not interact with us at the inquest as a family because we had a conflict of interest, which I still to this day find amazing, because I'm there to find out what went wrong and to get justice for my son's death. So what in the hell, if we've got a conflict of interest, was WorkSafe doing? And I stated that to the coroner. So getting back to culture. So when we pulled out the notice that showed that inspector did have the legal right and obligation to do that, WorkSafe were amazed. They were not even aware that he had the right. So for the 2 years we were arguing, nobody even bothered to check. Again, I go back to culture.
This is the right under the health and safety legislation to actually stop work.
To actually stop
risk.
To turn that power off. He had the legal right and an obligation to do so. So from that, and I'm building into the federal issue with this, from that, after the inquest, they had a review into that inspector's actions. They also had a review because of the charges that were laid, right? The building company got an $80,000 fine and no conviction recorded. The electrical company got a $90,000 fine, no conviction recorded. Now, this is the first case in Australia's history where a man is now in jail for manslaughter in a workspace, I'm told. But that's the low fines we got. So when this review was then taken in, it was done on investigations, prosecutions, and the inspector's actions. And I imagine it's a very costly review. It's not cheap. It took months and months and months. So we were invited, when that review concluded, to go talk with the person that conducted the review. He said the inspector could not be blamed because he wasn't electrically trained. It doesn't matter that on this notice he identified such things as bare live electrical conductors, incorrectly wired RCDs, apparently, because he hasn't got a ticket, he couldn't be blamed. Well, go figure. So then, on the investigation, they said the investigation was very good. They didn't even investigate this person. I investigated him. The referrals they should have made to police for the criminal activity that was going on, i.e. tampering, and the fact that things were not in there, they were lied to in the investigation, they knew all this. But that should have all been referred to police. Was not referred to police. So, as far as I'm concerned, if you've not investigated every bloody thing and you're not made any referrals, well, then you haven't got a good investigation. And they said the prosecution was very good. Again, someone's now in jail. How can such a low fine, with all that went on, be an appropriate result? So what I'm getting to is this whole waste of money, and that's taxpayers' money, into these reviews, which then say a department that should have done a job and did not do the job at the time, nowhere near to, close to satisfactory. How is it that they can get such a good result from a very costly review? To me, they didn't need a review. They knew that that inspector should have turned the site off. They knew that they should have educated their inspectors to turn sites off. They knew their investigation was not that good because they didn't investigate this bloke, really, plus other parts of the investigation that were not done thoroughly. And the prosecutions can't have been good because of the low result. So we've then spent a hell of a lot of taxpayer money on something to be told that we're okay when we're not okay. Now, in my opinion, how this comes about, and I would imagine this goes on with every regulator, is the moment they feel attacked is let's have a review. But they get to set the brief, and in this the brief was very broad. They'd given this bloke plenty of scope. There was no reason for him to come back this way, so he had to be useless, in my opinion, to have come back with what he did. Or is it that if you come back critical of a department, you might not get a tender again? I don't know. You make up your own mind, but I really can't see how this is well-paid taxpayer money when it's something so very obvious that you need to fix yourself.
Do we have a copy of that review? Do you know?
I'm not sure.
Can you actually identify it on the Hansard for us so we can look for it?
Warwick, can you help me out with that review?
Well, maybe
Kevin, can you remember what that review was called?
Oh, well, you can give it. You can organise and give it. Send us a note over the course of the next couple of days, if you like.
Make a note of that review that was done.
What, Tim Lyons?
It was an internal. It was an internal review, so I might not be able to get a copy of it.
Right. Okay.
But yeah. So, look, I don't mind the fact they do a review, but it's got to be comprehensive and it's got to come back honestly, because this is the problem. If we're not being honest, and if our governments are not being honest about their involvement or lack of involvement, whatever it may be, then how in the hell are we ever going to get it right? And just as something to add to that, so they've had this review where they're not to be blamed, right? Even though the inspector gave so much latitude to these people, that's what allowed my son to be killed. Well, I think around that time frame, well, that review was conducted, or just after it, the extension on the Dreamworld inspections, a 7-month extension was given, and 4 people were killed in that time. Do you understand where I'm going? No honesty? If they'd have been honest, do you think they might have turned around and said, no, we don't grant extensions on these things? That's my point with this, and it is a worry. So, again, that's federal money, as far as I can see, that's being spent on these things. And maybe they need to be conducted in a far better manner through an independent party you know, such as your state ombudsman or your coroner, whatever may be appropriate. The other part in this, as you can see, again, in my submission with the education, and I've put it in there, this electrician, there is no way known he should have got a qualification. Not even close. I wouldn't trust him to wire a torch. Yet he was put in charge of such a big development. That was a big development. It was inevitable he was going to kill someone. Unlucky for us, it was our son. Unlucky for anyone, really, but it was our son. When we chased this down and were told education is a federal issue, that's when I wrote to Simon Birmingham. I got an answer from a Senator, Scott Ryan, and I thought I had an answer from Senator Simon Birmingham or Minister Birmingham, but either way it says that the testing is state's responsibility. Well, the state were not aware of that. So
that in itself is extraordinary. Like,
so we have a breakdown there, and that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I think it's the federal government's duty to keep reminding the states all the time, whether it be annually or every second year, remember, testing is your responsibility. Because, as I've stated, the way now education is set up, because it's been privatised, is if I'm going to pass everyone that comes to me, word is going to get around. Go to Michael Garrels because he'll pass you. You'll get a pass mark. You'll get your ticket. So I'm going to get busy. But if my wife was doing the same thing, but she was really hard and diligent and said, no, and only passed 40% or 50%, then who are they going to come to? You know, Blind Freddy can see what's going to happen with education if we continue along that path.
But the state does have the direct responsibility for licensing of electrical work in each jurisdiction.
Yeah,
and it's extraordinary to me to hear that any regulator doesn't know what their legal obligations or enforcement.
Well, let's remember that the regulator wasn't aware that their inspector could shut down a site too.
Well, again, I'll come back to that, but again, that in itself is extraordinary. One of the underpinning bases of all the jurisdictional occupational health and safety legislation is that the power of inspectors to actually close a job down. In fact, workplace health and safety representatives have a right to do it.
Look, that's what I'm saying. My concern is, because as a nation we are so production driven at the moment.
Well, that's
by
where I wanted to come to just briefly, and I know you've got other things you want to cover, but you're going to actually table those notices for us. But
yep.
You've indicated that on both the improvement notice, well, two improvement notices effectively, but one identified an immediate risk to health and safety. What the regulators actually entrusted to regulate those laws, why do you think they didn't take the next step and actually do it?
Because I think this production culture, again, and this is the importance of a committee to me, I think that the pressure that is put on these people high up in the inspectorate, I think there is a lot of pressure put on them to not stop production, don't stop production, and that filters down to their inspectors. I don't think this was a one-off. Again, that's why I'm pointing to the Dreamworld tragedy, because I really don't believe it to be a one-off thing. There's too many cases where they are aware things are going on, but they're doing everything in their power to not stop production.
Mr. Garrels, are you aware of why the inspector was there in the first instance?
Because they got an official complaint.
Right. An official complaint or an anonymous?
Anonymous, sorry.
An anonymous complaint.
Now, what had been going on, as far as I'm aware, was anyone that raised any complaints on that site, because it was done with all subcontractors, was told to go. So what really broke my heart in all of this, when I was preparing for the inquest, I went through every little bit of every statement. There were so many people on that site that were aware of what it was. One bloke who'd only just got there, he'd had a big argument with another bloke about the state of the site, and it was an older bloke, and he said, "Oh, I've worked on worse, blah, blah, blah," as old blokes do. And he tried to warn my son. He said, "Be very, very careful." And my son, being the bloke he was, just smiled and said, "It's all right, mate. It's not that bad." That was Friday. He was killed Monday. But all of them knew. But that was the only one that bothered to warn my son. So in his mind, it would have just been, "Oh, this bloke's a whinger because I know the alpha are out of blue with him, blah, blah, blah." You know, that's what I mean. Like, it's... Everyone turned a blind eye because they knew if they didn't, they were going to be off that site.
Our role, of course, isn't to revisit any of the inquests or the prosecution, but I am interested to know how many people on site, in your view, were aware that the safety switches were deliberately tampered with.
I don't know that they knew they were deliberately tampered with. I think a lot knew that they weren't there. Nearly every boss amongst the subcontractors was saying to their blokes, they put their own safety box exactly where they were working, and they told their workers they were not to reset past there. The foreman and the electrician and the principal contractor were going up to that box over 30 times a day to reset the power. Then from one day to the next, it stopped. And that's, we talk about prosecutions. That principal contractor, he knew, because he'd come out in the inquest, he had a whole discussion with Nathan Day because the cable size was wrong. And because they had got him there, that he was under the impression he just had to do the infrastructure, so that means put in permanent straight away. And they said, "No, you've got to set up temporary power," because they don't like to put in permanent first because it may get damaged in the building process. So temporary power was put down. None of it was done to, not even close to standard. There was no standard whatsoever. I know that the principal contractor told him, just put power points on wooden stakes at each site. That's how it was originally set up. But then they had this whole discussion about the cable size, because he'd measured the wrong size cable for the length of run and the load. That's why it was tripping out. When he went to them and said, to the principal contractor and the developer, said, "You need to fork out for this cabling," right? They said, "No, that's your responsibility. You've taken this on. You've got to supply it. You fix it. Fix one day to the next." Any fool that has any kind of experience on a building site knows if that cabling was not replaced, the only other answer was to remove the safety switches. That's when he did it, and that was around the time, probably the time my son started, that I could make out through the evidence. So he was very aware. He had to have known. There is no way a man with 40 years' experience does not know that. Now, further to that, there were photos that come out in the inquest of him pulling out illegal fixtures out of the ground attached to the box that killed my son. The phone recording, of which I've got a transcript, in that, he says the electrician called the machine operator, who thankfully recorded this, and he said to him, he's telling him, "You've got to say that Jason, on his own accord, was told to go clean up, and he grabbed that switchboard and moved it after pulling the cables out of the bottom and touching the switchboard." In other words, Jason did it all himself. No one asked him to do anything. He killed himself. "Mr. Day, again, if you need to write that down, mate, I'm happy to stay on the phone with you." He said, "No." He said, "I've got it." And then Mr. Day, who is talking to Mr. Kershaw, says, "Yeah, mate, yeah. J- Jason said he found he sourced his own solicitor. Mr. Kershaw said, what's that? Mr. Day, Gary, that's the principal contractor, saying you need to be in touch with Jamie. Maybe you wanted Jamie's solicitor or something like that. We're trying to all work together. Mr. Kershaw said, no, I know we'll all work together with Jamie. I've got Work Heath and Softy on my back now. Cool. I mean, he's in Brisbane. I've got a local bloke in Rocky, so it's all cool. Okay, yeah. We're just trying to sort out a solicitor up here for you. Now, they're both saying that Mr. Labuschagne was not present. Well, you read it for yourself, and I heard it. There's someone there, along with the photos, along with the discussion beforehand, yet I cannot, and I think it comes down to money, I want the police to charge that principal contractor because he's now tampered with the site of a crime because of the manslaughter.
Have all the inquiries now ceased, or are there still some matters under investigation?
Well, I'm hoping and I'm urging the police to keep investigating this.
Right, okay. No one's told you there's now a line drawn under the case that it's over?
No.
All right.
No.
Well, that probably leads me nicely to another area I wanted to talk to you about. And Ms. Garrels, I want to give you an opportunity too, because I know you've put in your own submission. But I did want to talk about, in your words, you talk about the lack of transparency, the fact that you're not classed as a stakeholder in the investigation and that you have no rights in the process. And this does seem to be some of the evidence we've already received, incredibly problematic for those people who are grieving about the process and simply want to know what's happened and what is happening in terms of investigation and why they can't be actually directly involved in being kept informed. So can you just take me through some of the frustrations that you had and maybe talk to me about the impact that had on you?
Basically, we weren't, as you say, key stakeholders. So there were things like our victim impact statements that were edited by the defence. So we couldn't even, they actually had big lines all drawn through it about how we felt it. And then Workplace Health and Safety said, well, you're not even included in this. This is our prosecution. You haven't even got a voice. Just take it as it is. So we were very upset, as you can imagine, because it's we're authors of how we feel. So in the end, we ended up going to the court proceedings and actually just cared it to the magistrate, and he accepted it as it was. But we were told, basically, this wasn't about us or our loved one. This is about a case, and this is how it becomes a statistic, a case, and you're not really included. Then you have the legal kind of greys where the right to silence. But when you actually look at, the morality of a family wants to know how their loved one died, and also for prevention so other families don't have to go through it. So, silence and a right to withhold evidence, I don't think has a moral compass. I understand their rights, but so does that family and so does that victim. In a code of conduct with the Queensland Government, it's about transparency, learning from our mistakes, integrity, to have systematic pathways. I could not believe there was nothing. There was no support for families. There was no pathways. There was no systematically dealing with the legal or OHS pathways. Like, I couldn't even get counselling. I was at my son's resuscitation for 8 months. That's just quite ludicrous, quite disgraceful, really. And I think a lot of this impacts mental health, prolonged grieving. If you've seen the study with Sydney Uni, there's a lot of evidence there. It shows mental health problems, stress breakdowns in relationships, financial, social, psychological. It impacts on nearly every marriages break up. It was very, very difficult even for Michael and I. We grieve in different ways, but even our family, our children, it's just like having a nuclear bomb go off.
So were you aware of who was going to conduct the investigation and how it was to be conducted?
Well,
we made meetings.
Parts of it, but it's only because we chased. And like with the with those victim impact statements. You know, it's pretty devastating when you go to the trouble. It's pretty hard to write one of those things. It's hard to do anything in this because you're not in a mental state. So you put them in and then you get them back and all this, God, you can imagine mine, there's pages just this blacked out, that blacked out, and then I'm fighting with the prosecutors themselves because they're saying, no, this is how it works, you've got to let that in. And I said, you can bite your ass. There is no way known that you are putting in that. And I had...
Was it just the victim impact statement?
Victim impact statement. So and they'd done it to...
And you as the victim?
Myself, my wife, my two out of the three kids had bits and pieces blacked out of it left, right and centre. Now, when... What I had to do, luckily I'd made...
Did they give you an explanation for that?
We could jeopardise the whole case because we've put stuff in there that you know, is not irrelevant to you motively and it's around facts to dealing with the case. And I said, well, but that is all relevant. All the facts to do with the case are relevant to the way we feel.
Well, you would have thought that all the facts had already been considered within the case.
Well, but that's the whole thing because they build it into a case... Right, the person becomes a non-entity. The victim is a non-entity by now. They build it into a case, so they have a way they're going to fight this, and it's done. I believe on financial grounds because, again, companies can get a tax deduction in this arena.
Yeah, well, I did want to come to that because that I've never heard that before.
If they're well resourced, they can just keep going and going and going, knowing that they will return to them at some point, where the prosecution, they've got a budget to work to as well. So with these victim impact statements, they were worried we would jeopardise the case. Luckily, I had made friends with a well-credentialed legal person here in Brisbane, and I went to him and I said, look, we're more or less told we have to accept this. And I said, no, I'm not accepting it. I said, I want to read mine, and I don't want one word out of it. And he said, well, you're right. You're author of your own witness statement. So you can insist they put it up without any changes. So when I went back to them and I said, well, I understand we are authors of our own and you will not change a word and you will ask the magistrate that I want to speak. They weren't happy, but they had to do that. But they gave the impression that we didn't have the right to do that at the start. And this is like... This went over 3 days, phone calls backwards and forwards the whole time. And as I said to my wife, because then she said, oh, I'm a bit worried, should we just agree to this? And I said to her, well, the way I view it is what's going to happen is going to happen. But if I agree to them doing this to my witness statement and they get what I think is a softer sentence, because I'm pretty sure they're going to get a soft one anyway, then I'm going to feel I helped that. And that's the last thing I want to do. I would rather risk it and have my say. And
Mr. Garrell, can I just clarify? When you did your victim impact statement, who blocked out stuff?
The prosecution.
The prosecution.
The WorkSafe prosecution.
The defence.
It was given to the defence, and
the defence
agree to what they will allow in it. So they say to the prosecution, take that out, that out, that out, that. They sent it back to the prosecutors with the bits blacked out that they don't want.
Okay.
And the prosecutors go, okay, we'll go back to the people and tell them that's the way it is. And that's what I mean. You don't know your rights in this.
So it simply had things like adjourning and strategising and delaying and 6 years, and ours is considered quick. So
no, it was three because it was the company trials.
So, but it is years. And, you know, things like using words to delay tactics and things like that weren't accepted because it was just they just didn't want anything of ours written
because
in there.
Because, of course, the defence is painting a picture of how good, responsible this particular company is. And they're talked about like an individual, which I find really stupid and offensive. You know, that, oh, this company is so good and the director of this company is so good and blah, blah, blah. Because they want to try and get a lesser sentence. So a witness impact statement that says, no, they're arseholes and they've done this, that and the other thing doesn't fit into what they're trying to get, if you know what I mean.
We didn't swear.
Mr. Garrells,
Sorry about the French.
No, that's all right. There has been someone go to jail, and we've got the Queensland government later in the day, and some of this I'll ask them, but I just want to get your understanding of where we're at too, even though the Queensland regulator isn't coming. They made a submission. But some of these things, we'll put questions to the Queensland regulator if, in fact, they're not coming at some point during the inquiry. But the person that's actually been incarcerated, what legislation was that under? Was that under the industrial manslaughter legislation, or was
no,
that
it was criminal.
Just criminal?
That's what I mean. It was the first case, and that actually says something about the system to me. That in, what is it, 45 years of WorkSafe legislation?
Yeah.
That this is the first person to be jailed for manslaughter? All the families you've talked to, all the families you're yet to talk to,
So it actually is the Queensland manslaughter legislation, industrial manslaughter.
No, it's not the industrial manslaughter.
No. Okay.
It was done before.
Yeah, it's in 2000.
All right. Okay.
But that's what I'm saying to you. That's the first in 40-odd years of WorkSafe legislation. That alone, to any thinking person, should tell you that the system isn't anywhere near close enough.
So just to clarify, because I apologise if
your
submission does clarify this, but what were the charges that led to the conviction, that led to the jail time?
Manslaughter and perjury.
Manslaughter and perjury, all right.
Now, to give you an idea of the lying that went on all the way through it, but in the inquest, the electrician was scheduled for 2 hours in the chair. I think he spent 2 days.
Just interject. If the families, let's say, in our case, Michael hadn't followed it up, like with investigators and everything else, it would have just fallen by the wayside. Many of the people that you see here are families. I've had to fight very hard for justice and follow-up and push regulators, push police, sort out why it wasn't, basically referred to the QPS at an early reason, why sites weren't secure. Like, really, it needs to be much more, the regulator needs to be much more diligent. They do need to include families of voice, because I personally think there was a lot of things in our case that Michael actually brought to the table, asking questions, getting them to investigate certain things. So I think many of the families actually, and in our case Michael, I don't think if Michael hadn't been chasing it up, I don't think they probably would have even maybe have gone to certain places.
So who led the prosecution that ended up in the manslaughter and perjury, was that ultimately police or...?
No, it's a DPP. I've just given you a letter there.
And out of what investigation? Was that the Health and Safety Regulator or the police then investigated?
The coroner referred it to police, because what happens... And this has improved due to the committee's involvement in Queensland now. That, unfortunately, everyone arrives, because the police arrive when a fatality first happens. Everyone arrives and goes, what a terrible accident. Well, an accident is, to me, I've got 30 acres. If I hop on my tractor, go off slash and I go down a hill and roll that tractor, that's an accident. This is an incident, but everyone views straight off the bat as an accident. There's always other people involved. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, I know it's words, but because they go in with that what they used to have was just the local policeman, who is not an experienced detective, he comes in and he does a cursory investigation.
So I just want to understand the process of the investigation. So the Health and Safety Regulator would have done an initial investigation. Was that concluded when the coroner then did their investigation?
Yes, the coroner can't call an inquest until that investigation and any prosecutions are afoot, right? If he gets in before they prosecute, that's fine, but otherwise he has to wait till the prosecutions. And again, that's one of the problems we have, is because, again, because of the tax deductibility of this, the more financially powerful a company is, they can weaken an inquest, because once a company charges against them, they will just fight it on all different kinds of grounds and get another adjournment, and delay. And there's people that have waited 7 years for an inquest.
So did the Health and Safety Regulator initiate any proceedings in their report?
Yes, they initiated the two company charges and one for tampering against the electrician, which they later withdrew.
Right.
They told us at the time, because I was a bit upset about it, that they wanted it to come out via an inquest because then it would be a criminal charge because they worried about double jeopardy. My understanding is double jeopardy can only apply under the same act. So, they could have, my understanding is they actually could have charged him with tampering and then got him criminally for tampering as well, because that builds into a conspiracy, and that's under the Criminal Act, that's under the WorkSafe Act.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, we're not going to be in a position to make judgments about those matters. But
no, I'm not asking you.
I know. Without sounding like I'm just stating the obvious, you're rather unhappy with, and I'm trying to work out, because part of our role is to make some recommendations about how the investigations and inquiries and participation of others can be made better and more seamless. But I can see that really at every level you're unhappy with the process.
The process that existed, I've got to say that I think the regulator is actually doing a little bit now due to our committee that's there,
right,
because we keep anyone that comes to us, we highlight where they're deficient, and I think that is improving in this state. But at that time, and yes, I'm still very, very, this is my son's death, you know, this is not there's nothing more important than death.
Yeah, no, sorry,
so
I
get
that. So
yes, I am very unhappy with the system.
Yes.
It's a terrible system.
But it's changed with our committee it's like a lot, as you see my submission, there's a lot of really huge improvements, coronial support.
But still a long way to go.
Yeah, there's a lot of legislation.
I just think maybe to help us, can you just tell us what you would like to see happen for anybody else that might be put in this situation? What would you like to see happen? It might just help us form some recommendations.
So our committee that was basically, and Michael's a chair, so it's made of affected people. I think it'd be great, this is what I'm here, is to advocate that you would establish committees like ours. And I mean, we've gone for a couple of years now, so we've gone through our, you know, what works and what doesn't work, so you could benchmark as a model.
I think from the committee's going to give evidence a bit later in the day,
the whole
too,
committee
are they?
As a model. But, you know, basically, with that research from Sydney, it tells you a lot about how families are. So, and a lot was advocated, you know.
Yeah. Sorry.
I
could just add a little
line.
Bit of detail to what Lee's just said. The original question was, how could we do this better?
Yeah.
As Lee said, with a committee. Now, the reason being is because it's a very individual journey. This is your loved one's death. So everyone has, at different levels, a different expectation of what should happen or may occur. And it's not necessarily one size fits all. And that's the problem with government, I think, and regulators in general, is they tend to apply everything as one size fits all. One size does not fit all. You know yourself in your own dealings. You like your dealings to be personable to what the situation you are in and what you can understand and how you see things should work out. And as my wife said, that's why I think as a committee, when people do come to us, because generally, unfortunately, it's probably at a late point, you know, in what's going on. But then we can help them then go to the right people, try to get the right answers, and at least have the support of other affected families, because it's very, very hard mentally.
And OAR also helps us network with other industry key holders across the board, which is fantastic, with ministers, with other industries, with policy, with, you know, training. So the training education, as you know, is the grassroots, and culture should start at the top, but often it's not. You know, we actually have a lot of companies out there that say a lot of lip service, but actually don't really get, there is a culture just, you know, about.
So who from government's actually driving the improvements and supporting? Like, is there a central person or department with the responsibility?
Or is it
no,
it's just evolving?
it's more that because this is an evolving thing, the committee is an evolving thing, it's about us learning as much as they have to learn, I guess. It's about learning who we need to talk to about what. Some things we go off on our own and do, such as we went and approached the Queensland Police and a group of us from the committee and sat down with them and said, look, you've got to get the right people involved that are good at dealing with people with that are being deceptive, you know, and you have to look at it in that way first. Oversight is oversight, and we're all guilty of that. And I don't think the harshest penalty should be levelled at someone for an oversight. But there's a difference between an oversight and a knowing action. And that's the way it needs to be looked at. Was this an oversight? Was it a knowing action? And then that's the way it goes from there.
I hear the frustration you've had with the justice system in this process, and I feel quite sympathetic. I have some experience of the prosecution system from the work I did before I came to this job. And it seems to me that, for instance, some of the reasons why information might have been taken out of victim impact statements, or the reasons why decisions were made to charge under one section and not another, have a perfectly explicable legal basis, but haven't been communicated in a way that is meaningful and that helps you to understand why those decisions have been taken.
No, well, actually, I'll go further than that, to be honest with you, respectfully. If the investigation had been conducted thoroughly, because the investigation is the foundation of what you build everything upon.
Sure.
If that investigation had been completely thorough, then we would have had different prosecutions and a different path.
I understand that. I understand.
But everything is linked.
Everything is connected, but at each point in the process, you're dealing with different people all trying to do their part in the puzzle, right? If it seems to me like at that prosecution stage, one of the big problems is you're not getting good information. You're not getting good communication about why things are happening. And I guess what I would like to hear from you, if you don't mind, is are you able to give us any suggestions as to how information flow through the justice system could be improved so that you weren't left in a situation of frustration about why the things you want to put before the court and for good heartfelt reasons isn't able to always be supplied?
I understood why what they were prosecuting and why they were prosecuting. I think you're wrong in that. What it was,
I'll give you
was
an example of what I mean. For instance,
yeah, I understand what you mean.
Well, I don't.
I'm pretty sure you
I don't know that you do. Just give me a moment. For instance, in a victim impact statement, it's really important that people in your position have the chance to express the impact of what's happened.
That's what it's designed for, isn't it?
That's right. But at the same time, there can't be information in there supplied that conflicts with other information that might be before a court.
This is an emotional thing. This is even just emotional.
So if there are circumstances where there's almost an editing of what you want to put before the court, what I'd like to know is, would it help for there to have been clear information provided about what could and couldn't be put before a court up front? Would it have helped to have someone assist you with the process?
What you're not understanding, Senator, is I'm of the opinion you put up the best fight possible, even if it means you may lose, right?
Sure.
You don't put up the softest option because you know you will win. And that's where the problem is, because unfortunately prosecutions tend to look at what they're going to win and how they're going to win it. And that's the picture they want to build, right? So this is fundamental, because I understood what they were telling me. I didn't agree with what they were telling me, because I'm going, no, 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 no. This should be at the maximum. We know what these people have done. You should be chasing the maximum. Their reply, no, we would lose if we did that because of ABC. I would rather they fought for the maximum and lost than fought for the little they got.
Did anybody mention to you the way that the decisions to prosecute had to be taken involved an assessment of all of the evidence in the context of what's called a prosecution policy, which requires those people to make decisions that took into account things like prospects of success in achieving a conviction in the case?
Exactly my point. That's what I'm just talking about.
Exactly. So,
but I don't agree with it.
Is your complaint then with the fact that there is a prosecution policy that requires a balancing of the prospects of conviction and the use of public money in the pursuit of that against the needs of victims? Are you suggesting there should be a rebalancing of considerations in the prosecution policy? I'm trying to get to the heart of what you want to see change.
Okay. Whatever it takes, in my books, is, and the others may disagree, other families may disagree, but to me, whatever works in regard to me, these things should be based on intent. There is an intent. There's always an intent. Now, as I said earlier, an oversight, $80,000 fine, I would have said was appropriate. And a $90,000 fine, I would have said was appropriate. And walk away and leave it at that. But in this case, with the evidence they had and the information that I knew they had, that was not even close to appropriate. So whatever rules they apply, what we're ending up with is, because they don't want to go outside and set a precedent, because then that's the ability to launch an appeal, so we don't go into that territory. Well, it's gradually making things weaker and weaker and weaker, is it not? Because that's the way I see it. We need for these to be fought on the grounds of which they are. And again, I go back to intent. Their intent was to profit. Their intent was to risk whoever was on that site to gain that profit. That's the way it should have been fought.
And I sympathise with that. So but a prosecutor has
need to change in reply, then change them.
But the prosecutors have to work to get the most, the highest possible outcome they can get for victims in the context of the evidence they have available. There's no incentive for a prosecutor to not work on the basis of the evidence that's in front of them. Were there any issues with the admissibility of some of the evidence you're referring to?
Well, they got someone in jail for manslaughter, so I'm guessing not.
Yeah, I think we may be going in circles somewhat here. Can I ask you about something slightly different?
Mm-hmm.
I really would like to understand a little bit more about the way in which the Interim Consultative Committee have worked to try and help grieving families through this process. Can you go into some detail about how, in a practical sense, you've been able to do that assistance?
Given that the committee
is appearing this
afternoon, which includes the Garrells and some others, will be back about that.
We might leave it. We can deal with it then if you'd like.
We've gone over time, so we might. And I did say I'd give you a little bit of time at the end, so I'll give you that. But given that you are coming back, if we just make that brief.
I think the basis of all these things, when we talk about law, just quickly, is about the... No, you speak after me. The way in which, like, non-convictions are viewed and what they were designed for, and now all of a sudden companies get them, directors are walking away. All of this money for inquests, reviews, prosecutions, all the rest of it, in today's user-pay society, why is it that they are not liable for the whole cost if they're found guilty? Why is it only just a fine that they either Phoenix as a small company or they're insured for as a big company, you know, and it's nothing. And maybe our prosecutions would be ramped up a bit better if we recouped that money. And I think it's based on the way companies are viewed. Those three questions I really would like to be referred to the High Court, because I think you need to get the proper answers from them as to where companies should sit and how they should sit to make to make this right, because we're prosecuting the car and leaving the driver alone too often. Mm. Mrs. Garrels?
Yeah, actually that last, what Michael just said about, you know, you're prosecuting an entity, which is just a business. It's not the person who made those choices. They tend to hide behind a veil of industry. So basically the insurance pays it, or it's tax deductible, the taxpayer ends up footing the bill, and then they phoenix and start again. So there's no real consequence, and I do believe as people, we learn by actions, behaviour and consequences. I think if the consequences are nice and clear, those choices that they make may be changed, because obviously with people, reward and consequences are an obvious psychology to people. So if they know that he might go to jail for killing someone, because obviously the electrician had a clear choice to remove that RCD, clear choices to shortcut, not put conduit, zippy tie things. He had put the whole site at risk, and unfortunately Jason was end up killed. But it was a choice. It wasn't just an error or a human error, it was a clear choice. So in seeing other cases that are around, there have been clear choices made to risk other people's lives. So I do believe that consequences being loud and clear, and also having clear legislation, especially around building sites and things like that, because some of the legislation tends to be quite grey, as in the law. So I think clear consequences unto people who are feel they can risk other workers' lives and not really have to... They just close down a business, insurance pays their fine, and they start another business. I mean, that's not even a consequence, is it, for a death? I mean, these people are very young men, and to be quite honest, if you actually plaster lots of these faces around, you get a lot more connectivity about our loved ones that have been lost. Most are very trusting young men, trust that their employer is going to do the right thing, and often that they don't. So, especially in the culture that we have of industry, industry, industry.
Well, thank you very much for your submission to this inquiry and sharing your story with us today.